I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Our guest this hour is the author of Who Thought This Was a Good Idea? And Other Questions You Should Have Answers To When You Work in the White House. Alyssa Mastromonaco served as Assistant to the President and Deputy Chief of Staff for Operations at the White House from 2011 to 2014, and Assistant to the President, Director of Scheduling and Advance from 2009 to 2011. And she did this when she was in her 20s, very young. She worked for Senator Obama on his campaign and in his Senate office beginning in 2004-2005. Also worked as Director of Scheduling for Senator John Kerry's presidential campaign in 2004. The book has a lot of amusing anecdotes about getting tampons in the West Wing, about her meeting, and we'll have to get to these stories with the Pope and also with the Queen. Because of the nature of her job, she traveled all over the world with President Obama to Afghanistan and to Iraq and many, many places. We'll hear about those stories and how difficult those were. The stress, the life of being in the West Wing, and how she feels about politics now, too. Well, there's a lot to talk about with her. And we'll be welcoming phone calls as well. The number to the book is just out. I'm not sure if you've had a chance to read it, but you may have any kinds of questions about the Obama White House, and she's game for everything. So here's how you reach the conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Hello, Alyssa. Thanks very much.
Kathleen, thanks for having me.
And you went to UW-Madison to boot, huh?
Sure did. Go Badgers.
Go Badgers. Look where you can land up. You can land up at the White House with a degree from UW-Madison. Yeah. The book is just wonderful. It is amazing when you sit back and think about it. You're out of your 20s now. But it's amazing the job you had and your responsibilities when you were a kid.
So I was in my 30s. I just have to say, I was my early 30s, but I was in my 30s. But it was still an awful lot.
It was an awful lot. Tell me about the day that you had been working for Senator Kerry, and when he was not successful with the presidential run, somebody said, tell me who it was again, remind me that, well, are you interested in this job? And it was with then-Senator Obama from Illinois, and you went to him, I love this, you went to him for a meeting for a job there and thought, this would be great, somebody who doesn't want to be president.
Exactly. My friend Robert Gibbs, who went on to be White House press secretary, people will remember, he said to me, oh, come on, like you must be unemployed. Do you need a job? And I said, I do, actually. And so about 2 weeks later, I found myself meeting with Senator-elect Barack Obama and didn't really think that he liked me that much off the bat. I definitely didn't walk out thinking it had been a slam dunk. And but about 2 weeks after that, he called me himself and said, you know, let's do this.
And so you said okay.
And then, sure.
Yeah, why not?
And why not?
Yeah. So you stayed with him, and then you wound up with this pretty remarkable job in the White House, Alyssa.
I did. I was with him for just about 9.5 years, and 2 years into the Senate, you know, things had really changed, and there was a real moment for him. All of the, right before the midterms in 2006, all of the candidates wanted him to come out and campaign for them, and the crowds were unbelievable, and his book events were selling out because The Audacity of Hope had just come out, and yeah, it was definitely not something that he was very focused on being, you know, the best senator from Illinois that he could be and serving the constituents. But, you know, it was kind of his time.
Mm-hmm. And knowing that you had gone to work for somebody who you hoped would not be running for president because you knew how hard that was, he decides to run for president. Did you ever say to him, oh, please don't do this?
I mean, you know, I'm not going to lie. I got caught up in you get caught up in the excitement and the moment. And I felt also that, and I say it struck me then, and it is the same sort of thing in my core right now. It would be very hard for me to say no to helping someone that I deeply believed could make a positive impact in the country. So even though I've left, I'm quite happy to have more reasonable hours. If someone came up in, you know, the next couple of years that said, you know, and I thought that they were like the vision for the country, who knows, I'd probably have to do it.
Yeah, so who do you have your eyes on?
Right now, no real eyes. We need to see who pops up. But I do love Senator Gillibrand.
Mm-hmm. You know who I think might be a rising star is Adam Schiff.
He has really come into his, like, I literally feel comforted when he speaks, and I did not really know him visually. You know, I couldn't have really picked him up out of a lineup a couple months ago. But no, I agree. He's very thoughtful and measured.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to go through a lot of territory here, but we spent a little bit of time this morning finding some tape of an event that you, of all people, Alyssa, scheduled for Senator Obama that wound up turning out just fine. So I'll play it for you, and then I want you to give us all the background information of why you sent this man there and how it really turned out to be a very good thing for him. This is a rally in Chester, Pennsylvania. And it was on October 28th of 2008, and it was a pretty bad weather day there.
So let me just finish up by saying this. This is not going to be easy, Pennsylvania. And you know that, because look at all of you standing here today. It's not easy standing in the cold and in the rain. You know it's not easy. But you also know this is time to come together. Some of you may be cynical. Some of you may be fed up with politics. A lot of you may be disappointed with your leaders, and you've got every reason, every right to be angry with your leaders. But despite all of this, I am asking you right now to do what Americans have done throughout our history. I'm asking you to believe. I'm asking you not to believe in my ability to bring about change. I'm asking you to believe in your ability to bring about change. And I know this change is possible because I've seen it in this election. I've seen the lines of young voters stretch around churches and schools. I've seen workers who'd rather cut back on their hours than see their coworkers lose their jobs. I've seen neighbors take in other total strangers because the floodwaters had washed people out of their homes. I've seen young soldiers reenlist after they've lost a limb. That's what America's all about.
Now, Alyssa, I believe you got a phone call from him shortly after that event, didn't you?
So, yes. And he sounded really inspired there on stage. But, yes, so most people know President Obama's from Hawaii and does not like the cold all that much. And so that day, right before the election, it was quite cold in Chester, Pennsylvania, and we woke up in Chicago and heard that it was snowing in Chester, and snow is not quite that bad. And we sent an email to the people who were with him on the road in Pennsylvania, and we said, look, we really think you've got to keep this event. Senator McCain is canceling all his events in Pennsylvania because of the weather. You got to keep it. You got to keep it. And they sent me an email back that said, who thought this was a good idea, which is where the title of my book comes from, because it wasn't the first time in the years that I had gotten such an email. And I said, come on, you guys, like, you have to do it. You have to do it. And as we were watching the event unfold on television, it turned from snow to sleet, and it was slapping him in the face.
Yes.
And we were cringing. We were just like, our heads were down on our desks. We're like, we're so screwed. And lo and behold, as he wound up that speech and finished up, he turned off stage and put his hand out, and we saw him put his hand out. And Reggie Love, his aide, put his cell phone in his hand, and about 10 seconds later, my phone rang. And he said, Alyssa, I said, sir, you did great, such a great response. You look so young and virile. And he's like, where are you right now? And I said, I'm at my desk. And he said, must be nice. And he hung up on me. That was probably the most angry he ever got. And it doesn't really, you know, register as total, like, totally angry. But no, that was a fateful day. But the punchline to the whole story is that the photo of him being smacked in the face won the Pulitzer for the Washington Post.
Remarkable.
Washington Post.
So you did the right thing, Alyssa, didn't you?
We did the right thing. Who thought it was a good idea? I did.
Exactly. And you were right. And that's why you rose among the ranks there. You learned, you say in the book, about leadership from President Obama. He isn't somebody who will make you feel like you have to prove yourself. He never yelled at or demeaned people.
Mm-mm. Very true. The reason that I think his leadership style is something that, you know, hopefully everyone would try to emulate is that he understood that you got the best work from people when they felt comfortable sharing their opinions and maybe taking a risk, maybe saying something crazy. And so, you know, if you said something that was insane or had a suggestion or an opinion, he was quite open. He encouraged us to really be a team.
Mm-hmm. You got to also travel with him, and you tell so many extraordinary stories in the book about going to, in 2009, to the UN Climate Change Conference in Copenhagen, about going to Iraq, going to Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. Why don't you start with the Climate Change Conference in Copenhagen and meeting with the Chinese? It's a funny little story about how he was able to get what he wanted.
It was, so that month was very busy. We had the climate change conference in Copenhagen. It was also the Nobel Peace Prize, which the president had been awarded that year, was also in that month. And then the International Olympic Committee was also meeting in Copenhagen earlier to pick the 2016 Olympics in Rio. And Chicago was a contender. And so we kept thinking, oh, maybe, you know, it wasn't clear that the Copenhagen Climate Conference was going to reach the level of consensus that leaders would actually attend. Most countries just had a representative there that was negotiating on behalf of the country. And so we get word that they're getting closer and closer from this gentleman who is an assistant secretary at the State Department, Todd Stern, for climate and energy. But, you know, they think the president's going to be needed. So we decide to go, but there are no hotel rooms in Copenhagen, and so we decide we're just going to go to Copenhagen. President and Secretary Clinton will seal the deal, and then we'll come back. A couple things happen. One, a terrible snowstorm starts creeping up the East Coast.
Oh, weather always gets in your way, Alyssa, doesn't
always
it?
Always gets in my
always.
Way. And so the snow starts coming up the coast, and we take off. We head to Copenhagen, and we land. And by the time we land in Copenhagen, it's early in the morning. It's like 7 or 8 o'clock. We motorcade over to the convention center, which was also like an expo. So where we spent most of the day was actually like a denim store. Like there were just jeans on mannequins. And so the president goes, he finds Secretary Clinton. They're having different meetings. And basically they had reached a consensus, except there was a rumor that the countries that formed an alliance, the BRIC countries, it was Brazil, India, China, South Africa, that that they were off negotiating something else, and they were going to negotiate as a bloc. And so President Obama is waiting to speak with Premier Huan, who was representing China, and Secretary Clinton comes over and finds me. She's like, Alyssa, I'm hearing people are leaving. And so I went to the Secret Service, and we started, like, you know, calling around, and we found out that the Indian delegation, Prime Minister Singh, had sort of headed off to the airport. So we keep trying to find South Africans and the Brazilians, and it turns out that they were all having a secret meeting convened by Premier Huan, and President Obama and Secretary Clinton decided that they were going to join the meeting. So they found out where it was. They linked arms. President Obama led the way, and, you know, Secretary Clinton had her elbows out trying to get through, and she actually tells a much better version of the story in her book. But and the Chinese guards were trying to block President Obama from going in, and the Secret Service said they'd never seen anything like it. And ultimately the president goes in to the room and sees the other delegations and says, "Hey, Wen, are you ready for me?" And they continued to negotiate. We're all just rot. We're like, oh, this is amazing. It's so exciting. It's like something from the West Wing. And then we turned around and found out that we had about an hour and a half to 2 hours to take off to get back to Andrews before every airport in a 150-mile radius was closed for weather.
Oh, my gosh.
So we had everybody loaded up on the buses, yeah, and the president's in there, and the military aide who carries the nuclear football with the codes, who's sort of like, He is the person who's in charge of all of the, like, with the pilots and everything. And he said, Alyssa, you have to pull him. And I said, no, he's so close, And so I didn't pull him. Everybody was mad at me. But the president came out a couple minutes later, and we got to Air Force One to take off with exactly 2 minutes to spare.
Oh, my gosh. And had a rough landing in Washington, but you just got in.
It was the roughest. It was definitely the roughest landing we ever had. But we got there safe and sound and made some progress on climate change.
Yeah, isn't that something? You never know what's going to happen. Right.
Exactly.
Now, sometimes issues, here you are, you're in some really high-level meetings that are going on here and meetings all over the world. You're about to meet the Pope. And as somebody who also suffers from irritable bowel syndrome, I know exactly what you were feeling. But you had this, you're going to meet the Pope, for heaven's sake. It's this big thing in the Vatican, and you feel an irritable bowel syndrome diarrhea attack coming on. Oh my gosh. It's a funny story. It wasn't funny for you, I'm sure, at the moment.
It was not that funny at the time. But luckily, much to some people's chagrin, I'm quite open about my issues.
Yes, you
are.
Because
if you're not, people think, you know, one, I think people should be more open because it's an embarrassing feeling. You
right.
know, all of a sudden, you're with all of these professional people. I'm with, you know, Susan Rice, who is National Security Advisor, and all these other folks, and I can feel my stomach start to become quite angry. And so, you know, you try to breathe through it. You're like, it's just all in my head.
Right.
I can get through this. And then it comes that moment where you're like, oh, my God, I've waited too long. This is going to be a disaster. And so one of the greatest perks of working in the White House is that as an assistant to the president, my doctor was actually the president's doctor, this wonderful man named
Not
Ronnie.
Not bad.
Yes, Doc Ronnie Jackson. And and Ronnie, you could be completely honest with. And I said, Ronnie, I'm going to have a real situation. And I couldn't find a bathroom anywhere. And so I said, Ronnie, I need the strongest Imodium you can possibly find. And so he pulled some out of his bag for me, but there was no water. And everyone's running around scrambling, trying to find water. And then someone finally brings me a glass. And I'm like, where did this come from? And everyone's like, don't ask. And I was like, oh, my God, did holy water.
Holy water. That's just what I was thinking.
Sort of embarrassing moment. But no, and so we walked in, and my friend Dan Pfeiffer, who's, you know, my brother from another mother, he was like, are you going to be okay, buddy? Are you going to be okay? And I'm like, just like, I'm breathing. I'm counting to 10. It's going to be okay. And, you know, lo and behold, I turned out to be okay. But that was the closest I ever came
to a
personal international incident.
My gosh. And you were in this stress. I know that stress can, and bad eating.
Makes
it
worse.
I believe you had eggs that morning, and you knew you shouldn't have had them, and there you are. And you're in a big stress situation, and it makes it worse. So you have this job where you needed to have those pills on hand all the time, really, right?
All the time. And I think anyone who suffers from IBS knows there's only so many times you can go to the well of Imodium before that sort of backfires on you, too.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, I'm glad you made it through, because it must have been an extraordinary moment to be with the Pope, right?
Incredible. And he is the most gracious, lovely, like warm person. And so I was really glad that I didn't have to bow out and like run into the cavern of the Vatican to find a bathroom, and that I was able to, you know, like maybe like God blessed me a little bit in that moment.
When did you go to Iraq?
We went to Iraq in, it was maybe late March, early April of 2009.
And that was a harrowing trip, too. You went into a sandstorm.
We did. And so it's one of the very interesting things. I think everybody who has seen, you know, when a president arrives in a war zone, it's always a surprise. You know, you wake up on the news and you're like, oh, George Bush is in Iraq. Barack Obama's in Afghanistan. And that is because Air Force One typically flies in radio blackout. So nobody can track you. Nobody can find you. And so we leave from I guess we were in Istanbul. We leave from Istanbul, and we have two planes, and one is Air Force One that's going to Iraq, and the other is what is the backup plane. Every time you fly abroad, you always have a backup plane in case anything happens. And so we decided that we were going to, like, pull a ruse, and we said that we put the people who shouldn't be going to Iraq on the backup plane. We said the backup plane was broken. We took off. And right as we were about to, you're about 45 minutes or so outside of Camp Victory in Iraq, and they lift the radio silence, and we start communicating with the team on the ground, and we find out there's a sandstorm.
Oh, my gosh.
And we're like, okay, what are we going to do? And we had General Ordierno was on the phone, and we came up with a plan that that whichever Iraqi leaders would be willing would come meet us, because when you... Basically, what would happen is we would have landed in Camp Victory, gotten on helicopters, flown into Baghdad to do meetings with, you know, Talabani and Maliki and some of the others, and we couldn't. And the president certainly cannot exit the green zone in a motorcade. Like, it's not an HBO show of Homeland. So we stayed. They found us a place. It turned out, I think, General Odierno's home was actually Saddam Hussein's mother-in-law's house back in the day. And so we sat outside, and the president met with all of the Iraqi leaders in this house. And I finally turned my cell phone back on, and my sister called me, and she said, "Sis, are you in Iraq?" And I was like, "I am. I gotta call you back."
Right.
But it was like one of those totally wild. It was a totally wild moment.
I imagine. And what would have been your work assignment during all of that, Alyssa?
So we sort of coordinated the logistics, making sure that, you know, all of the, you want to make sure when you're going into a foreign country, like if you're flying over, trying to think of a good example, if you are stopping in Germany to refuel on your way back, or, you know, when you're flying over some people's airspace, you want to make sure the right countries are notified. You want to make sure people in, you know, whether it's the Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, that everybody, that there's a chain of notification once you've either, you know, starting the day or two before you leave.
Really?
And once you take off. And so there's a real, it's what we would call like the critical path of things that need to happen. And so I would run, I was basically the master of the critical path, and I would make sure that everything was happening in real time. And then you check in with the CIA to make sure the conditions on the ground are okay. We had a trip once that we were considering taking to Afghanistan once, but it was actually snowing and we couldn't go. So those sort of things, you need eyes and ears on the ground, but nobody ever knows who your eyes and ears are because they can't.
Right. So you have to, all these arrangements have to be made because it has to go off flawlessly, right?
Yes, exactly.
Hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls for Alyssa. Our guest this hour is the author of a highly entertaining and thoughtful book, Who Thought This Was a Good Idea? And Other Questions You Should Have Answers to When You Work in the White House. Alyssa Mastromonaco is with us, and she worked in the White House as assistant to the president, director of scheduling and advance at the White House from 2009 to 2011, and as assistant to the president and deputy chief of staff for operations at the White House from 2011 to 2014. Right now, she works as an executive at A&E Networks and is a contributing editor at Marie Claire. She says that she still has a twinkle in her eye for politics, so she may, if somebody wants her again, which I imagine they would, she may enter the life again. We'll talk more about life inside the White House and the first day on the job, which is pretty interesting, and some other trips that she's taken, and welcome phone calls. Here's how you reach our conversation. 800-486-8655 is the number. The email is ideas@wpr.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. And this is the Ideas Network. Frank in Onalaska is our first caller, Alyssa. Hi, Frank.
Hi.
Hi.
Interesting talking to your guest. I appreciate you taking my call. My question is regarding the 2010 elections and, you know, the general loss of federal offices and the state houses, governorships. My question, and I'm been a President Obama supporter, my question there, how did the staff, the president, allow that to happen? Because it was so critical for the second term, and obviously the Affordable Care Act was part of the reason for mm-hmm. for it all. But I just was curious as to, I've got my own take on perhaps why, but I'm curious as to what the inside explanation is to why, you know,
right,
the all-important elections. Cause,
all right.
Sure. I mean, I can tell you, I don't think that we saw that sort of turning of the tide in the way that it actually happened. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of people who took the vote on health care, like the Blue Dog Democrats, you know, fell victim to the 2010 election. But it's certainly not anything we saw coming that we, like, willfully ignored, if that makes any sense.
And what about the current election? What were your thoughts? Were you convinced that Hillary Clinton was going to win? What do you think of the current direction of the country, Alyssa?
So I would say that I thought Hillary Clinton was going to win. I think it's hard to have been a part of so many campaigns and have worked in the White House and see someone like President Trump, who campaigned in what was a quite cavalier way. And so I hope, you know, I believe strongly in the peaceful transition of power. I think that's what makes our government special. So I was rooting for, you know, when President Obama came out the day after the election and said that he invited President-elect Trump to the Oval Office, I said, you know, if President Obama can do it, we should all do it. And I think that I personally thought after Trump won that he would maybe, you know, calibrate a bit and not be quite as radical or sort of pandering to TV and social media. But it hasn't happened. I'm a little concerned, and I think, you know, going back to 2010, today is the 7-year anniversary of the signing of the Affordable Health Care Act, and I have to say it's a bit, I think it's in poor taste that today is the day they wanted to.
Oh, I didn't realize it was today.
Yes, it's today, and so they purposefully wanted to vote it down today. So I guess that's sort of where we are now.
Mm-hmm. And yet there's a bit of a hullabaloo about the vote, isn't there? It looks like at least at this moment, at three,
yes.
Who knows what will happen during the rest of the day, they may not have the votes.
It says, yes, currently it says a GOP source says no vote tonight, but who knows?
Oh, right? No vote tonight.
That's what they're saying, but I wouldn't be surprised if it comes back.
Interesting. Was that the piece of legislation? You've had a chance to speak with the president on many occasions. Was he particularly mm-hmm. proud of that? It was a hard-won battle.
It was a hard-won battle, and he believed in it deeply. He thought all Americans should have, you know, affordable access to health care. And, you know, at the time when he was told the political toll it might take on him, he, you know, he said he'd rather be a one-term president and do what's right than sort of fudge on this. And so in terms of leadership, too, that is something I don't think any of us will ever forget.
Frank, thanks so much for your call. Cindy in Fox Cities. Hello, Cindy.
Hello. Well, it sounds to me like you had the dream job of a lifetime.
And, it was quite good.
I'm sure you probably had to learn a lot of what you learned on the fly.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just curious to know, how many languages were you fluent in?
So I was fluent in French, and I was conversational in Japanese, which I...
Japanese, really?
Yes. I was a French major until I met Bernie Sanders and switched over to political science. But yes, and we always tried to learn a few key phrases in any country we were going to so that we wouldn't be sort of like the crass, rude Americans that think, you know, everyone should speak English.
Mm-hmm.
So we always tried to learn, you know, some of the customs and a few key phrases.
Hmm. You worked for Sanders for a while, didn't you?
I did. I was an intern. I was an intern when I was at school in Vermont, and it was a wonderful experience. He gave me a chance, and something I think that my friends in Wisconsin will maybe remember is that I actually worked for, when I was sitting there answering Bernie Sanders' phones in Burlington, Vermont, I was about to move to Madison, and the phone rings, and I see a 608 area code. I said, oh my goodness, this person's from Madison. I answer the phone, and it was Ed Garvey.
Oh, really? Oh, my gosh.
And so Ed was as lovely as could be. Bernie was running late. And I said, oh, you know, I was a little forward, I guess. I said, oh, I'm moving to Madison in 3 weeks to go to UW. And he said, well, when you get here, let me know. And when I got to Madison, I went to his office, and he employed me for the 2 years that I was a student.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I didn't know that, Alyssa. He was a wonderful man.
A wonderful,
yes.
Big-hearted man. I was very sad to see he passed away a few weeks ago.
Yes. Oh, I didn't know you had a connection with Ed Garvey.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I did. He's a one. He kept me going. He was the most. Bernie was progressive, but Ed was even more progressive. And so, and I know he ran for governor, and I volunteered for him a bit. But yeah, he was a very special mentor to me.
Oh, that's nice to hear. Very nice, Cindy. Thanks very much for the call. You tend to think, because so many administrations tend to bring in people from Harvard and Yale and all of these fancy dancy East Coast schools, so some people will feel very heartened by the fact that you went to UW-Madison, which mm-hmm. is a great school. Among the top public schools, certainly in the country. But did you get the impression that Washington was overloaded with Ivy League graduates? And how did you, as somebody who came from a Big Ten school, find yourself, you know, at the top of that whole group?
So I will say, one, I could not have been more proud to have been a Badger. And it is, you learn different you'd learn different traits, you know, in different places. And if you are in a small, you know, Ivy League school, yes, maybe you get more attention, like, you know, student per faculty ratio. But I will say that when you go to UW, you learn how to navigate. You know, because back when I was in school, there wasn't even, I think we had just started doing touch tone registration on the phone. But if you wanted a class, you had to go hustle for it when registration started. And, you know, you come into, you know, my graduating class was 10,000 people or something
right.
like that, of course. And so I learned how to I really learned how to interact with people. I think I honed my people skills in Madison.
Mm-hmm.
I worked really hard. I got the best education I probably ever could have gotten. And I felt that meeting such a cross-section of people from all walks of life, to me, is probably one of the, you know, top three reasons I wanted to go to Madison, because it is quite diverse. And I love the school spirit. And so I know how to be a cheerleader. I mean, like, not actually, I don't put a skirt on, but I mean, I appreciate, you know, I love to get in there. And so I think that, you know, one of the funnier moments in the White House was when myself and Robert Gibbs, who went to NC State, I think Gibbs went to NC State, one of the snottier people said, oh, you two must feel so out of place.
Because
you know, everyone on the corner of the table were talking about, you know, their private school reunions and such. And Robert said, you know, appears to me we got the better end of the deal because we all ended up at the same table.
Oh, what a great answer.
Yes, and I will tell you that after I left the White House in 2014, there were several universities that approached me about, you know, coming and speaking and doing things. And I said, the only thing I will do is go to the University of Vermont and the University of Wisconsin, the two schools that wanted me when I was just, you know, a lowly 18-year-old. And so I'm actually on the board of the Honors College at Madison and, the Board of Visitors in Madison and the Honors College at the University of Vermont.
Isn't that great? Good for you. And I can tell just from talking to you, and there must be some people who find this refreshing, that you're just, you know, who you are now is who you are when you're talking to the president or Robert Gibbs or, you know,
that's
who knows
exactly
somebody
right.
else. And that's good. It's good to be genuine, I think.
I agree. You know, I think that every time I've tried to be something other than, like, who I am, when I try to be much more proper or, you know, hang out with people who I actually don't want to be hanging out with, I'm not the best version of myself. And one reason I think that I have sort of come to be, you know, relatively successful professionally is because I have only been me and only work for people who let me be me.
Mm-hmm. It's a good thing.
It's the best outcome for everybody.
Yeah. There are some people in the world, though, and I guess we can mention names here. I believe it was Timothy Geithner who, when he was in the West Wing, looked at you and said, would you please get me a Diet Coke?
No, not Tim Geithner.
Oh, who
no,
was
no,
it?
No,
okay,
no,
I didn't want to get the wrong person.
No, it was Larry Summers.
Oh, it was Larry Summers.
Yes, it was Larry Summers, who I now affectionately call Lair Bear. because at the time, you know, and my good friend Dan Pfeiffer will always say that I always assume the worst before I recognize the best. And it's a terrible characteristic, but it's true. And so I was sitting there, and it was in the transition office. And Larry came swirling in. He was having a meeting with the president. And he said, can you get me a Diet Coke? And I sat there in a huff. And I'm like, ah, of course he asked me. You know, I'm
right.
the woman.
Right.
The truth is, there was no one else in the room. I looked, because I had gained a bunch of weight on the campaign. My cheeks were nice and round. I looked literally maybe 17 years old. And if anything, it was perhaps ageism. But after that, Larry and I actually became the best of friends. And so I always tell people, you know, there I was. I jumped to conclusions. I got in a tizzy about, you know, sex discrimination, when really, really I was just the only person in the room and 20 years younger than he was.
Yeah, exactly. You did have meetings, though. Tell us about, because there aren't a lot of women wandering around the West Wing and working at the West Wing. There was a group of women, senior staff women, who would get together for dinners regularly that you were a part of, right?
We did, and that was one of the best parts of sort of our coven that we formed. And the interesting thing that I don't know if I made the point clearly enough in the book, but there were actually a good number of women in the West Wing, but the reporters loved to write about, you know, the bro club, the white boys club in the West Wing. And we would laugh. And finally, one day, we went out for a reporter dinner. And they said, you know, what do you guys think? And we're like, do we not count? Like, here, there are like eight of us right here. Like, are you saying that we don't count? Like, who are the people you're expecting to arrive that are going to be the women that finally count? And they said, oh, you know what? It's like they had never thought of it that way. But we did just for a sense of community. I always appreciate a good sense of community. All of the senior women in the West Wing and Susan and the chief of staff to the first lady and the cabinet secretaries that were women, we would go out for dinner maybe once every couple of months, and we would just have a great time, and we would laugh, and sometimes you'd pick a question and everybody would have to go around the table and answer the question, and you know, I could get advice from people, and it was a very special opportunity for me.
Mm. And you are responsible for tampons in the women's bathroom in the West Wing.
Yes.
It's you.
It is a perfect example of sometimes you just have to ask why. Because we would go downstairs to the women's bathroom, and this is something that I think all of us that worked in the West Wing wish there were more bathrooms. But you'd go downstairs, and there was no tampons. And if you needed to go across the street to CVS to get them, it was a whole rigmarole. And so I used to have to send my assistants, who are both young men, over to get them for me sometimes when all the ladies in the West Wing were out. And so one day I was like, I finally asked one of the women who reported to me, Katie Kale, who was the head of the Office of Administration and in charge of things like putting a tampon dispenser in the West Wing. So, Katie, is there any reason we can't have one? And she said, no. So a week later, there was one.
By golly. Isn't that something?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely it is. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. And, well, here's who we're talking to this hour, in case you're just tuning us in. Alyssa Mastromonaco is joining us, and Alyssa is the author of Who Thought This Was a Good Idea and Other Questions You Should Have Answers to When You Work in the White House. She was in her 30s when she was working in a high-level position, assistant to the president, director of scheduling in advance from 2009 to 2011, and assistant to the president and deputy chief of staff for operations in the White House from 2011 until 2014, and she's written about her experiences. She worked for Senator Barack Obama as well, and worked before that for Senator John Kerry in his presidential bid. Here's the number, 800-486-8655. Email is ideas at WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and Twitter is at K Dunn Show. We welcome your calls for Alyssa, and we'll take more of them in a moment here on the Ideas Network. Welcoming phone calls for Alyssa. If you want to join the conversation for the remaining minutes, 800-486-8655 is the number for you to call. We have not talked about meeting the Queen. You've got, and I wouldn't share this, but you really kind of love the Queen. And
I love the Queen.
I know you do. I don't know why. I'm not sure why anybody loves the Queen, but you can tell me why you love the Queen. But it was a big deal for you to meet the Queen, and the story is really, it's very funny. I mean, embarrassing, I'm sure, at the moment, but it's a good story.
It is. So I need to tell you why I love the Queen.
Okay.
When I was growing up, my Oma, my grandmother, she was from Germany, and she would receive all the German magazines in German, you know, because it was, like, fun for her to be able to, you know, see what was happening back there.
Right.
And the magazines always had, you know, all of the royals and the monarchs in Europe. They were always in the rags. And so my Oma and I would sit there and go through them with her, and there was always something on the Queen. And so I just grew to love them so much. And I know it's crazy. And when I got the chance to meet the Queen, I was so excited to tell my Oma that, you know, I was going to go and meet the Queen. And the president knew that I have this fascination with the royals. And so we were going over. It was the 60th anniversary, known as the Queen's Jubilee, of her being on the throne. And so we were going over to celebrate her and throw her a party at Winfield House, which is the U.S. Embassy in London. And so I had a proper dress. I was sick as could be. I was so sick. I was on all these British cold medicines, which are just much better than the ones in the U.S. And I went and I got a proper blowout for my hair, and I put my dress on. I pulled myself together. And we go, and there's a receiving line, and we meet the Queen, and I could see the president look at me like, don't maul her. Like, don't just, like, shake her hand politely and just move on, Alyssa. And so I met her. I said, "Oh, Your Highness, so, you know, wonderful to meet you." And I curtsied. And then I went on. And that was all I saw of the Queen that day. And we stayed at the party, and it was lovely and so much fun. And we heard through the State Department and the protocol office that the Queen loved Broadway. So we brought Kristen Chenoweth, who did some Broadway tunes, you know, on as our performance at the end. And it was so great. And the next morning, we were leaving. I forget where we were going. And when you are on Air Force One, usually like 6 hours or 7 hours before the plane's going to take off, you have to put your bags out so that the White House military office can collect them and have them swept by the dogs. And so if you're leaving in the morning, you usually are just allowed to have a tiny carry-on to take with you onto Air Force One that you, like a carry-on. So since I was not going with the President and the First Lady to Buckingham Palace to say goodbye to the Queen and take Marine One, you know, off the Buckingham lawn, I just had on jeans and a sweater and my tweed blazer. And so I was brushing my teeth and getting ready to leave, and Reggie Love knocks on my door, and he says, "Boss, the boss wants you to go with them." And I said, "Reggie, I can't. I'm in jeans. Like, what? I can't do that." And Reggie says, "I'm sorry, do you think I'm going to tell him that?" He's like, "You tell him that." And I was like, "Never mind, I'll figure something out." And so this whole thing, the President had set up this whole almost ruse. He had kicked somebody off of Marine One so that I could take their space in this instance so that I could visit Buckingham Palace. And I walk in, and the President and First Lady were ahead of me, so they had not seen me at this point. And they went in to see the Queen, and then I was in the drawing room, hiding behind a couch, reading magazines, so that I would not be detected, that I was literally in what I'm sure they refer to as, like, dungarees. And, right, we're getting ready to leave, and I'm begging the valets that work in the military office for me to let me carry some bags so that I can cover up that I have these jeans on. And they would not let me. They said, "No, ma'am," because technically they reported to me. And they're like, "No, we're not giving you our bags." And so I walk out to Marine One. I take in the view. I look back. The Queen and the Prince are, like, waving, and all the staff is out waving goodbye. And I'm just overwhelmed by the moment. And the President looks at me, and he goes, "Jeans, Alyssa, jeans." And I was like, "I know, I'm sorry. I thought I was going in the buses to the airport." And then he looked closer, and he said, "What's that?" And I had in my effort to try to distract everybody from my jeans, I was pretending to read a magazine when we were in the drawing room. And unbeknownst to me, I took it with me, and it was a Tatler. And I stole a Tatler from Buckingham, and I apologize profusely.
And I hope you still have it.
It is somewhere. I do have it.
Yeah, that's quite a story. Georgia and Shawno. Hi, Georgia.
Oh, hi. Yeah, a couple things. I'm so proud of Alyssa. Good for you. You go, girl.
Thank you.
You know, for all you've done. I am wondering if you keep in contact with President Obama now. I think we're all very saddened about the presidency as it is right now. But I'm wondering, how is President Obama doing?
So I spoke with him right before he left office, because he's been traveling a bunch now. And I think all of us wanted to give him his space. It's kind of like when you've been on a family trip together for 8 years, and then you get home, and everybody just wants to go to the store by themselves.
So we're
just letting him go to the store by himself. But I can say that it does look like he is, that he is at least having a good time learning how to kite surf with Richard Branson.
Those were great pictures, weren't they?
Weren't they terrific?
Yes, they were. Did he try to fix you up with somebody?
The president? A few times.
That's great.
He was very concerned with our personal happiness. And so several times he would tell me, one super funny time was out in California. We were at a fundraiser, and he was talking to Lawrence Bender, who some people may know. He produced the Reservoir Dogs and all the Quentin Tarantino movies and An Inconvenient Truth. So he's quite famous and quite a bit older than I was. And the President comes back, and I'm literally like a bump on a log. We're so tired. And again, Robert Gibbs and I, he's always present for some of my better moments. we were sitting on the couch checking our Blackberries, and the president came back, and he's like, what are you two doing? We're like, oh, we're so tired, which, by the way, is not something you tell someone who's about to take a photo line with, like, 200 people.
Right.
We're like, woe is us. And he said, Alyssa, there are someone in the other room that you should meet. Come with me. And I was like, I don't want to. And he's like, you are not going to meet people if you sit on the couch all the time. And I was like, who do you want me to meet? And he said, Lawrence Bender. And I was like, from an inconvenient truth? I'm like, no. And I just went back to my BlackBerry. Luckily, he did not mind when I was a bit sassy.
He probably appreciated it. Oh, those
he
are
He did.
Just...
I was the comic relief at times when we were on the road.
It was so sweet of him to try to fix you up, though, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. You know, I think that he felt a certain responsibility for all of us that, you know, it was this one time we were, it wasn't one time, it was the time I was moving from Washington, D.C. to Chicago because the campaign was getting underway. And he called me and I was quite sick. And I answered the phone. I was like, hello. He's like, where are you? What are you doing? And I'm like, I'm in the car. I'm in Toledo. He's like, why are you in Toledo? And I'm like, because I'm moving to Chicago to work for you. And I think it was the first time it really registered in a big way that we were all uprooting our lives. Mm. And he never took that lightly, ever, ever, ever. Not in the White House, not on the campaign. And so he knew that I was someone. I wasn't married. I didn't have kids. He knew I had a cat. But he always tried to make sure that I was, like, not staying home every single night, even though, honestly, I would just prefer to sit home and watch, Brothers and Sisters and Parenthood. That was really
right.
My escape.
Exactly. I'm sure it was an exhausting job. Thank you so much, Alyssa. The book is delightful, and you were so informative and great stories. And I'm so glad you went to Madison because that formed your life here in many ways. And
yes,
it's good.
Wisconsin.
On Wisconsin. Thanks, Alyssa.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Yeah, you too. Alyssa Mastromonaco, our guest, and the book is Who Thought This Was a Good Idea? And Other Questions You Should Have Answered To When You Work in the White House. Probably the youngest person to have had her job. She was in her 30s. I'm sorry, not her 20s. 32 years old and traveling with the president and doing the scheduling. And it's really quite something. So we thank her for being with us. Thanks to Colleen Duvall for producing the hour and for on-air production as well. Well, I can't believe this is happening again, but twice in just a matter of a couple months, I have to say a fond farewell. Scotty Myers is going to be leaving us today. Well, he's here tomorrow, but I'm not here tomorrow, so it's his last day. He's been an extraordinary producer, and I wanted to thank him publicly and find out the kinds of shows. He brought so much to the air here, all of the community groups who have been trying to lessen violence in the city of Milwaukee. Has been a very curious person who reads avidly, and anybody who whistles, you know, he's a really good whistler. He is. And I thought, that reminds me of Mrs. Henneberg from 8th grade, who used to whistle every morning. I thought, I like this woman.
That's
She's
funny.
A whistler, and Scotty is a whistler.
My dad's a whistler.
Is he?
And so what he would do whenever we went on family vacations and it was, you know, super crowded, us kids would maybe wander and get lost a little bit. Dad would do a certain whistle. And then you kind of know where he is. And that's how we sort of find each other.
Oh, and that's good for dogs, too.
Good for dogs.
Yeah.
You know, that's really funny. I just wanted to comment on Alyssa's show that Robert Gibbs might be the only person who goes from the White House to McDonald's. Usually it's the other way around.
Exactly.
Usually you start at McDonald's and then go to the White House. But
right. Yeah, she was fun.
Yeah.
So, Scotty, you're going. Scotty's leaving. You know, you just think you're going to have some people around forever and ever, and life never works that way. But I just wanted to thank you publicly for the kind of person you are. You are just so exuberant and smart, and you've just been terrific to work with and to let people know where you're going and give them a chance to say goodbye to you. Probably not on air. We don't have much time, but go to our Facebook page and write messages, The Kathleen Dunn Show.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm going to absolutely miss this place. I'm going to miss you. I love everyone here, and it's. I think the reason why I have that sort of energy is because it's contagious. So I'm so sad to leave Wisconsin Public Radio. It's three things I believe in. I'm a huge homer. I love everything Wisconsin. I love public institutions. I think the Wisconsin idea is a holy thing, and I love radio. I think it's the greatest medium ever invented, which is a little bit weird. Why I'm going to the dark side. I'm going to TV. I'll be starting at Milwaukee PBS on Monday to sort of work with mostly attached to their news magazine program called 1036. But boy, am I going to miss this place. I'm going to miss you. I'm going to miss talking to people like what today's shows were. You know, you think about our first hour with Jake.
Marvelous hour.
And our second hour with Alyssa. That's sort of both sides of the Greek mask, you know, tragedy and comedy. And those are the stories of our lives, and it happens right here from this downtown studio, Studio B, and it happens on the Kathleen Dunn Show, and it happens because of you and the team that we have here and all of our listeners at home.
Yeah, and from you, too, and KPU, who left us a little while ago. But your interest in what you've brought to the air has been so important. I hope you recognize that you've brought some really important voices that we don't very often hear from.
Yeah, I think that's something I take pride in, is finding atypical people to come to public broadcasting. But, you know, we're just the folks on the perch. You know, we're just sort of at the lighthouse looking out, and it's all we really do is invite people to come in. It's the people who are amazing. But there's so much stuff happening in this city, in the city of Milwaukee, that it's worth exploring and scrutinizing and just having a conversation about. So I'm going to miss that tremendously.
Well, I'm going to miss you. You're like family, so I'm sure we'll see each other again. But
amen.
Thank you, Scotty. What
thank
a joy it's been to work with you. And please go to our Facebook page and let Scotty know how much you appreciate all the work that he's done. Thanks, Scotty.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Yeah. Oh, I'm going to cry again. I've been crying all day today. Oh, dear. Thanks to Scotty Myers for all he's done. Thanks to Colleen Duvall for producing the hour you just heard and for on-air production. We'll be with you again Monday for All Things Political. Thanks for listening.